Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. The latest draft for how to manage millions of acres of federal lands in southwest Wyoming attempts compromise, but
I would certainly anticipate if concerns can't be resolved during the protest or consistency review, that's a good indication of issues that could be raised in litigation.
It's been a pretty big year for wildfires in Wyoming. The state fire management officer says working with partners has been key.
The color of the land on a map doesn't matter too much. Everybody just kind of shows up and gets to work.
We hear from students at the University of Wyoming about changes happening on campus, like the possibility of carrying concealed weapons.
Bad idea.
Personally, I'm in favor of that.
I think it's hard to say.
And we check in with retiring State Senator Affie Ellis. Those stories and more on Open Spaces. Stay with us.
Want to keep up with local news but can't have your radio on 24/7? That's where Wyoming Public Radio's email newsletters come in. Get all of the local and regional news you want in your inbox. You can choose if you want an update every day or a weekly roundup of our top stories, or both. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
This time on The Modern West, an interview with the guy who started a visionary new ranching program at the University of Wyoming.
We're also placing a lot of emphasis on public land and public land management because Wyoming is 50% public land.
The Rancher of the Future. It's a bonus episode for the re-release of our series, The Great Individualist. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. The Fish Creek Fire has been burning for nearly a month up on Togatee Pass. It's around 2,500 acres moving through dry forests in the mountains. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman reports from the fire's base camp on how a camp crew from the Wind River Reservation's been tackling the behind-the-scenes work needed to keep the operation running.
Right off Highway 26/287, going up Togatee Pass, a dirt RV parking lot the size of a football field has been turned into a temporary town as hundreds of firefighters work to protect the surrounding cabins, lodges, and roads.
This is a very, very busy spot because this is essentially the center of fire activity from a logistical standpoint.
That's Morgan Faber, the base camp manager for the forward operating base that's set up just south of Togatee Lodge on the west side of the fire. Every morning, the parking lot is packed for the daily briefing.
This is completely full of cars, and we have about another 75 vehicles out on the highway.
There's a big dining tent, a trailer with showers, catering kitchens, a medical tent, a mechanic, and even a mobile gas station.
And they run over the thing and a ding ding, and the guy comes out and he'll help fuel up any of the trucks.
It's all set up to support the firefighters who are camped in a big field a few miles away. They work together with the Incident Command Center located on the east side of the fire in Dubois.
We're just in charge of, you know, making sure everything that is here in base camp, from porta potties, dumpsters, all of the lovely behind the scenes things that everyone needs, that's kind of what we manage.
This temporary town doesn't just appear. It takes work to set up and to run.
We build a town and then we tear it down. And it's really amazing to see how that process works. And without our camp crews around, I don't know how we would be able to get it done.
Enter Wind River Camp Crew Number 1, a team from the Wind River Reservation that tackles all those odds and ends. Teresa Swimmer is Northern Arapaho and from Fort Washakie. First up on their agenda, get up and make coffee.
Wake up at 5 a.m. in the morning. First duty is to get to breakfast, get that done, counting the meals for the catering, hand out lunches to the firefighters, wipe down tables, pick up trash. When the trucks come in, we unload ice, we unload Gatorade.
After a break while the firefighters are out for the day, Swimmer and her team do it again for the dinner rush. She's been working on camp crew for 15 years and says the work is hard, but they get through it together.
We're doing an awesome job and we all appreciate each other and we're all communicating. And that's where basically it's mostly at is communication.
During that midday break, the 10-person crew grabbed folding chairs and crammed into one of the yurts to talk all things camp crew. Tara Jorgensen is Eastern Shoshone and is a first year on the crew. She says her least favorite thing is...
getting up super, super early, but hey, it comes with the job.
She says the flip side is learning new things every day.
Everybody is expecting action and everything, but like behind the action, it's like there's more action.
Mavis Willow is Northern Arapaho and camp crew boss.
I love being out here. I love camping. I just like to be on my feet all the time and just, you know, stay as young as possible as I can.
She's from Ithidi and says working in the fire world runs in the family.
My father, he was a World War II veteran, and he kind of disciplined us that way. And he was a firefighter also. And the whole family, just as they grew up, they joined him.
That tradition is still getting passed on. Willow has two grandkids on the crew, but she says it's all business on the job.
I'm not grandma here, but I'm their boss.
Jason Stevenson, Northern Arapaho, is from Fort Washakie and used to be a firefighter.
I got some bumps and bruises that I can't heal up like I used to when I was young. So, you know, camp crew is a lot better, a lot more easier than being out there in the mountains fighting fire.
Stevenson's been stationed at the supply yard and is training to take on the receiving and distributing manager role at fire camp.
For me, it's way to advance further into this, you know, as I'm getting older, turn into the career side of it.
As for what keeps him coming back?
There's a lot of things about this country that, you know, we want to save and keep part of our country and just practically being part of the whole team. And it feels good when you know it's finally out, everything's done, and you did your part to help out.
While most fire assignments are 14 days, the Wind River camp crew was asked to extend for one more week, thanks to all their hard work. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman from the Fish Creek Fire Operating Base.
And now taking a wider lens look at wildfires across the state. Wildfires have burned homes and killed cattle this summer. Just this week, several new fires sparked evacuation orders in Campbell and Albany counties, and crews still have their hands full with the Fish Creek Fire on Togatee Pass. Wyoming Public Radio's Nikki Woulette recently caught up with Jared DeLay. He's the state's fire management officer. They talked about how this year stacks up and what can we expect from the rest of the season.
So far this year, the governor's office says we've seen 600 fires in the state, about 630,000 acres burned. How does this compare to recent years?
You know, just with my short time state forestry and that 25 years with the Forest Service in Wyoming, I don't remember really seeing just that volume of acres. I don't remember having a year quite like this. The number of fires is probably not so far out of the norm, really. But realize that there are probably a lot of fires that just haven't been quite recorded or reported yet. And they're just waiting on that till they get time to be able to do that. Now we're having a lot of grassland fires and, brushland, some timber and stuff that are impacting a lot of land ownership as well. But it's just a lot more private land fires. It's just abnormal for that number of private land fires.
Yeah, ag land has been particularly hard hit with these really fast-moving, scary grass fires. I'm curious, like, what have you seen on the ground? Like, where are the worst impacts?
You can go back to end of February, first part of March, when we had the large fires just outside Cheyenne. You know, they impacted some of those smaller HOAs and little subdivisions on the outskirts of Cheyenne. But then you also look at the large fires up in northeast Wyoming at that time of year, that's a big impact to those rangelands up there in private lands. You know, there's not going to be probably a lot of moisture, you know, till the snow that to really grow that stuff back, to regenerate the grass. So that's impacting those producers up there as well, quite heavily, from winter range to fences to everything that they lost up there.
Are you expecting that we're going to see fire season, specifically grass fires, continue into the fall and winter? I know we've had quite a few number of new starts even this week.
Yeah, most likely, just for the amount of fuel out there. And we just haven't had a lot of moisture recently, you know, in the southeast part of the state here, Cheyenne. Yeah, we've done kind of fairly well over August. But, you know, you drive around the rest of the state, you can tell where it gets a lot drier. So You know, I know there's some predictions out there with some upcoming weather and some fronts coming through here in the next couple of weeks. Hopefully that gives us some reprieve and we just don't get, you know, the dry wind that we could, I guess, and the warm temperatures that come before the fronts as well.
Have you been able to access the kinds of resources that are needed to fight these fires? And I'm thinking both equipment and people.
We get pretty stretched, pretty thin across the state, but we've been kind of lucky really to be able to get what we kind of need when the need arises. And the Rocky Mountain Area Coordinating Center in Lakewood has done a pretty good job of pre-positioning resources in Wyoming, and the BLM Forest Service has been good about bringing in some additional pre-positioned aircraft as well that in Wyoming, everybody has access to.
That's great. And I know like a lot of initial attack is done, I mean, sometimes just by people who are just on hand, have equipment. But I also know that fire departments in the state have been having a really hard time staffing and finding volunteers. How is that affecting communities' abilities to protect themselves?
There's definitely an impact to those fire districts and counties. And even with the amount of starts that we've had, it seems like they've come in clusters. You know, we get real busy for a week or two, and then there's a little bit of a lull. I mean, it's taxing to these departments and counties as well. In Wyoming, it's a pretty small group of folks that do a lot of between the state, our county cooperators, and our federal partners. It's a small group, so it's pretty important that we all work together. The color of the land on the map doesn't matter too much. You know, everybody goes, where there's a fire, where there's a need, everybody just kind of shows up and gets to work.
I'm curious what you think about how fire adapted are Wyomingites. Do we have a good culture of living with wildfire?
You know, historically, it's always been part of it. You know, you can talk to a lot of the folks that have been in Wyoming that have been on fire departments or ranchers that have done it for a long time. You know, that's just part of the culture and part of that comes with the territory. You know, then there's even, you know, new folks that move into the state from out of state. Yeah, I think they're starting to understand it, that, you know, it's part of it. Especially if you come from an area that may not have a lot of wildland fire, moving in via your chunk of Wyoming that you want to get away from everybody, you know, you learn pretty quickly that that's part of the deal.
With all of the fire that has happened on private lands this year, what would you say to homeowners, landowners who are interested in doing some work to kind of protect their homes and lessen impacts?
Reach out to your district with Wyoming State Forestry, and you know, they could do a site visit and see what can help be done.
What would that work potentially look like?
Depending on what it is, what grants could be available, see if we could partner with other entities or other, you know, landowners and stuff to, you know, to do a bigger area maybe. And just developing those plans and seeing how that work can get done, or, you know, whether it's contracting out to somebody or depending on the area, the homeowner may be able to do it. So it's just, you know, figuring out the right tool to use.
Is there anything that I haven't asked that you wanted to talk about?
You know, it's just always, especially this time of year, when we come into fall and it's dry and you'd have those windier days, you know, just be aware of what you're doing outside. If you're mowing, if you're doing any work out there, welding or something, or even just general recreation, and especially during hunting season, if you have a fire, just be aware of your surroundings and make sure you spend a little bit of time, a little extra work of making sure your fire's out and pretty cold before you leave.
Jared DeLay, Wyoming's State Fire Management Officer, thanks so much for chatting about the fire season.
Yeah, thank you.
What do different stakeholders think about the latest draft of the BLM's Rock Springs Management Plan? That's up next on Open Spaces.
Wyoming Public Media is providing Wyoming and Western wildfire updates on air and now online. Go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on Wyoming Wildfire Info. You'll find links to the latest updates on fires around the region, along with information on current air quality conditions, fire restrictions, information on protecting your property, and more. Find it all in one place at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Check out the Wyoming Public Radio Politics Quiz. Are you up to date on the latest state government news? If so, test that knowledge out. In this week's quiz, the University of Wyoming replaced which office following diversity, equity, and inclusion cuts? Think you know the answer? Find out at wyomingpublicmedia.org and click the WPR Politics Quiz tab.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. And now we turn to Southwest Wyoming, where people are butting heads on how to manage 3.6 million acres of federal lands. The Bureau of Land Management just released their updated draft plan for overseeing energy development and conservation goals for the area, and it comes 1 year after the initial draft was released that sparked outrage among many. Here to explain is Wyoming Public Radio's natural resources and energy reporter, Caitlin Tan.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Caitlin, when the BLM first released this plan last year, people were outraged, right?
Big time. The BLM outlined four options, as you might remember, everything from status quo to lots of energy and land development. And the BLM selected the infamous Alternative B as their preferred plan.
Right, Alternative B.
Alternative B, which prioritized conservation of land and wildlife above all else. But many locals felt like the BLM wasn't balancing multiple use of federal lands. I remember attending a BLM information session in Big Piney, and just looking back at even the photos I took, people were visibly unhappy, frowning and crossing their arms. Take a listen to local Bob Dexter, who interrupted the BLM presenter.
Leave it alone.
I want it gone. Whole thing. Throw it in the trash can. But who's in favor of B? Is there anybody in this room that's in favor of B?
No.
So there you have it.
Okay.
Nobody.
So I'll finish my slide.
And, you know, people felt like the agency was using a heavy management hand, too. In fact, it was kind of representative of where we are in time as a country. You know, a lot of mistrust and disdain for the federal government.
And if I'm remembering correctly, didn't the BLM make a mistake in that initial draft?
Yeah, a pretty major one. They said they'd shut down thousands of miles of two tracks and roads. Now, the BLM said that wasn't supposed to be in the plan, and they did actually take that out.
Okay, so let's fast forward. The BLM took public comment, changed some things around, and a few weeks ago released a final draft plan. What's in it?
Well, it's an attempt at compromise based on the 35,000 public comments the agency received. It, you know, eases back on the conservation-heavy approach and allows some more energy development. Some wins that mostly everyone seems pleased with, prioritizing conservation and hunting in the greater Little Mountain area, south of Green River, and also protecting energy development in the known sodium leasing area, which that's in Sweetwater County and is key for the trona industry there.
Okay, but the governor's office and other elected officials seem to think not enough was done to allow the energy industry to thrive.
Yeah, actually, Governor Mark Gordon highlighted that there are still too many areas of critical environmental concern, or ACECs. This designation is used to protect important historic, cultural, and scenic areas. Right now, there's about 286,000 acres that have this special protection, and this final draft ups that number to 935,000 acres.
Wow, that's more than three times as much.
Yeah, and the natural gas industry also isn't happy with the ACECs. It closes off the area to any drilling, and I should note that one report shows there might not actually be a lot of natural gas there anyway. But I spoke with Ryan McConaughey with the Petroleum Association of Wyoming, and he says that's not the point.
If the industry doesn't think that they could make a profitable well in an area, they're not going to drill. And so I think we need to allow those options to be in place and let the market play out.
Initially, the BLM proposed closing a lot more land to drilling, but they'll end up leaving about 70% of the land available for development. But even so, McConaughey says the oil and gas industry feels unheard.
I know there's a lot of ranchers in this neck of the woods. How are they feeling about this?
Definitely some reservations there too. I spoke with Jim McGagna with the Wyoming Stock Growers. He says for livestock grazing, he's pretty satisfied. Only 0.005% will be closed, so pretty minuscule there. But he's worried about those ACECs I mentioned earlier. Grazing is currently allowed on them, but he thinks that possibly anti-grazing groups could use that as a way to block grazing in the future. And he's also concerned of how this will all line up with other federal plans. You know, there's the sage-grouse management plan and the public lands rule. And McGagna says he wishes it could all be in one concise, easy-to-follow plan for land users.
And because they're each done separately, for the average person that's dependent on these lands, it's such a challenge to put all that together and say, what do I have when all those things happen? And maybe others that are still coming. So still very nervous about where we end up.
And then what about the conservation and wildlife folks? How are they feeling?
They're a little more pleased, it seems, than others. They're definitely fans of the ACECs. Lauren Marsh with the Wyoming Wilderness Association says to her, this is the BLM saying the environment and wildlife matter. And also,
you know, they're really important to a lot of different tribal nations that have ties to these places. And so we're prioritizing those things.
But some concerns include big game migrations. Initially, the draft had outlined no surface disturbance within a key mule deer migration corridor, the Hoback to Red Desert. But this final plan scraps that and says drilling will be allowed as long as companies avoid or minimize disturbance.
Got it. And real quick, a lot of people have been worried that the plan would close public access to much of the area. How much truth is in that?
None. There's basically little to no change from what people can do there now.
Okay, so it sounds like mixed reviews all around. I'm sure more feedback to come too. So what happens now?
Well, there's about a week left for people who previously commented to say what they don't like now. And the governor has another month for a consistency review where he looks for discrepancies between this draft plan and existing state and local laws or other land use plans. The BLM will then digest all of that and release its final resource management plan. I spoke with Temple Stollinger, a law and environmental professor at UW. She says this could be a very telling time.
I would certainly anticipate if concerns can't be resolved during the protest or consistency review, that's a good indication of issues that could be raised in litigation.
And for what it's worth, lawmakers have indicated that Wyoming will sue if it's not satisfied with the plan. Stollinger says it could easily be tied up in court for multiple years.
Just curious, we're in a presidential election year. Gordon and others have said this plan is part of the Biden administration's attempt to shut down Wyoming's core fossil fuel industry. Could the results of the election change things at all?
Well, it's funny you should ask. Stollinger says she's actually not totally sure. It's kind of a gray area. But it's not like the BLM is creating a whole new rule. It's just updating its land use plan, which is required of the agency.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Caitlin, for sitting down and explaining all of this to me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
As students at the University of Wyoming settle in for another year of classes, cold weather, and cowboy football, they're also in for some potential changes. The university is considering whether students can conceal carry firearms on campus. Lawmakers recently axed funding for diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. And so Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger caught up with students to ask how they're thinking about life at and after college, and whether they'll stick around the state after graduation.
At the direction of Governor Mark Gordon, UW is considering changes to its policy about concealed weapons in public spaces, like here in the Student Union. The Board of Trustees will take up comment on a September 26 meeting in Laramie. Until then, here's what Miles Wilson, second year, Bowden Tuminello, third year, and Madison McMahon, first year, had to say about concealed carry policy.
Bad idea, but I guess since we're in Wyoming, I don't think people, it's not like it hasn't been done before with or without policy, so I mean, hopefully it wouldn't make a big difference.
Personally, I'm in favor of that. I've got friends at other college campuses throughout the U.S. that allow that. I'm surprised it's not a thing in Wyoming. I don't think it would cause an issue because so far my interactions with people here on campus, specifically those that would carry guns, have been very positive. Everyone seemed extremely responsible, and I can't see it being a problem.
I think it's hard to say because from where I'm from, and like my family background, concealed carry is like okay, just because men suck. So it's like safety for women, especially in situations where a man can overpower, but it's also like with, you know, school shootings and such, it's hard to have that in a school environment. It depends on the people and how they're gonna use it.
In May of this year, lawmakers cut block funding to the University for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Programs. UW's Multicultural Affairs Office has since been changed to the Polk Center for Community Resources, and any clubs under the former office will have to be self-funded. Here's Geraldi Romero Garcia, a second year.
It's devastating because I still remember on the first year I transferred here, back in 2022, it was there, and I actually got to know a lot of people. Plus, I feel like a very safe place, very diverse place, and I was devastated when I found out this semester that they closed it down.
Also a second year and a former Wyoming Public Radio intern, Peyton Holstrom said she didn't know much about the closure, a common view among students around campus.
I feel like that's probably going to have a couple negative effects, considering like that's probably something our campus would need.
Yeah.
The Cowboy State has struggled to retain young people and graduates in recent years. Many first years, like Bodie Smith, who are still exploring the possibilities, like Wyoming.
Yeah, I've lived in Wyoming my entire life, so I really enjoy it here. Ideally, I would like to find a job here, but yeah, definitely an economic reason. For everything else, I love living here, so.
Second years like Misha Sami Hakan and third years like Vin Meester have more concrete ideas about their career, which reflects in their view of Wyoming.
Well, I'm already started looking for jobs, but not many jobs in Wyoming, so it's more about Colorado. They have, like, most offices have a branch in Colorado rather than in Wyoming. So, yeah, I'm thinking of moving from Wyoming to Colorado or nearby states like Utah.
Yeah, so I'm a policy analyst, so I work for the state government. I can really find a job anywhere, but I think ultimately Wyoming's politics have a tendency to be very partisan towards conservatism and towards the right side of politics, and so it's different. It's difficult for people like me who often work in very nonpartisan environments to find careers without having very outspoken conservative views in politics in Wyoming. So it's unlikely that I'll end up staying here.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Jordan Uplinger.
Up next, Senator Afi Ellis talks about why she is leaving the Wyoming legislature. This is Open Spaces.
Sometimes the news can be a little hard, but Around Wyoming is here to bring you the lighter side of things. Ever heard of frozen chicken curling? Or do you know how many of our residents compete in and win national competitions? Hint, it's a lot. Around Wyoming brings you that and more 4 times every weekday. You can also find Around Wyoming on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Coming up on Wyoming Sounds, it's New Music Wednesday with me, Melanie Nielsen. Join me for new music from Cowboy Ross Cooper, The Fratellis in Babe Rainbow, Fruit Bats, Corp Lund, and this one from Galen McKinney from the McKinney Zone. Tune in 9 to noon for Wyoming Sounds on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kodalska. Senator Afi Ellis is a member of the Navajo Nation and a key figure in the Wyoming legislature. As the first Native American woman to serve in Cheyenne, Ellis led the Select Committee on Tribal Relations. Earlier this year, she announced her retirement from the Senate, where she helped pass legislation relating to the missing and murdered Indigenous peoples crisis, among other measures. Wyoming Public Radio's state government reporter Chris Clements spoke with Ellis about her departure.
You're the first Native American woman to serve in the legislature. I mean, when you came to Cheyenne to start that work, what was the dynamic like at that time for you?
Well, when I was first elected, there was only one woman serving in the Wyoming Senate, and it was a lady named Bernadine Kraft who had just announced that she was retiring. And so my daughter, who was really young at the time, I took her into the Senate to watch some debate, and she innocently asked, you know, Mom, do they let girls be in the Senate? And I whispered to her, of course, honey, there's one out of 30 right there. And so the notion of there being no women in the Senate really was jarring to me. And so after a lot of soul searching, it was definitely a contributing factor for my decision to run. So after being elected, you know, you start filling in your certain shoes and certain roles that you maybe didn't anticipate. And, you know, providing a female perspective on some bills. And then obviously being a Native American serving, those were just natural things that I maybe didn't seek out to be a voice for, a representative for, but just kind of came naturally to me. And I'd offer that, you know, years ago we did a commemoration event of the 150th anniversary of the signing of the Treaty of Fort Laramie. And we had all the Wyoming dignitaries there, U.S. senators, Governor Meade at the time, all taking the stage. And the program was going on a little long. And so, my first instinct in being humble was to just forego my time on the stage. But as you look in the audience and see that there are other people there wanting to see representation that looked a little more like them, I thought it was important to offer some remarks just because I think especially for little kids to see that representation really matters. And I've been incredibly humbled over the years that I've been serving and having students come up to me and admiring my work and knowing things I've worked on. It's been so humbling. And those are things that I will always cherish, those experiences.
What do you think about the future of Native American representation in the legislature now that you're retiring?
You know, certainly as an attorney who practices in federal Indian law and has practiced in tribal law, I definitely think there will be a hole of people who are aware of some of the issues that are out there and just have my legal training and background. That said, there are candidates from Fremont County who are very well versed in these issues. You know, Senator Case has been a longtime leader and has served as the chairman on the Senate side of the Indian Affairs Committee. So I know that they'll be able to pick up a lot of that work. But, you know, just from my own perspective, I have brought a lot of my knowledge and background to those issues. And I do think that's a difficult thing to replace just because there aren't that many of us that practice in that area.
And in your opinion, I mean, should there be more tribal members from the Wind River Reservation who are serving as legislators in Cheyenne?
Well, I think that's up for the community to decide. Over the past several years, I've worked with Representative Larson, who is non-Indian but is in Lander, and he works incredibly hard to be knowledgeable on those issues, and I served as a co-chair with him and was always impressed with how much effort and passion he brought to those issues. And so for me, it's important to have that representation and that voice, but it's really ultimately up to the citizens of Fremont County to decide.
What was your experience like as chair of the Select Committee on Tribal Relations?
I think the thing I've enjoyed about it the most is, you know, there are issues like missing, murdered Indigenous women, crime in Indian country that I've always been passionate about. You know, once you start raising your concerns and start asking questions and start asking other agencies, can we be doing more? It's just created this groundswell of people that are now working. And it's not just me. You know, certainly the governor's taken interest in this. Tribes have taken an interest in other advocacy groups. But seeing like the amount of interest in crime in Indian country, particularly violence against women, in the last 8 years in Wyoming has been amazing. And I'm really proud of all the people that I've gotten to work with to elevate that conversation.
I mean, when you had the chance to visit the Wind River Reservation, you mentioned the missing and murdered Indigenous peoples crisis, but were there any other topics that community members brought to you that stuck with you or any interactions that have stayed with you?
There have been so many conversations and things we've worked on that affect the Wind River Reservation. And, you know, one of them that was one of the more challenging things I've worked on was getting codification of the Indian Child Welfare Act at the state level. Prior to that, there's a federal law that requires adoption proceedings anytime a parent might lose or have their parental rights terminated in a court for certain protections to be involved if there is a Indian child involved, such as allowing tribes to intervene and be notified of those proceedings. And at the federal level, there was some concern that parts of that might be overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. And so really the states would have been a backstop for, you know, such a decision. And so we looked at that issue, and initially I didn't think it was appropriate for timing-wise for us to take that on, but the more I thought about it, the more I realized that it was critical and necessary so that we wouldn't have any confusion or kids slipping through the cracks. So that was a heavy lift. It was not an easy thing to get accomplished, particularly in a conservative state like Wyoming. But I think, you know, some of those conservative values of keeping family units together really resonated with some conservative members who did vote for that bill. But it was a tremendous amount of work and, you know, really reflected a long going and on, you know, many decades and generations of hurt for Indian people from losing their children in state court proceedings. It really was the belief that it was better for Indian children to be removed and placed with white families where they would be detached from their cultures. So there's a lot of history that goes along with working on an issue like that. And I knew it was really important. So that one really stands out as something that I've worked on that I was really proud of.
Do you have any regrets from your time as a legislator? Any things left undone that you wish you could have gotten to?
Absolutely. You know, I've worked on school safety issues for a lot of years, and we always had the ability to get them out of the Senate with strong support, but they always hit a wall when they hit the House. I find that incredibly frustrating because at the end of the day, I don't think we're doing enough to make sure our schools are safe. But those are just some of those barriers. You just have to recognize the things you can change and the things you can't.
When you think of your time, like as a lawmaker, how do you hope you'll be remembered in general?
Well, sitting in the Capitol building, you look at the walls and you see, you know, 100 plus years of composite pictures of legislators who have come before you. And it's always interesting when you go in there and you look and you see a picture and you're like, huh, I wonder what that guy worked on in 1923 that mattered. And at the end of the day, you kind of think, well, I have no idea. And maybe it doesn't matter, but it does, right? It's the laws that we write, things that are codified in the green books. You know, did we do a good job of getting it right? To me, that's what matters. And so I'm not so worried about the legacy of my name being on that. I think what every legislator should strive to provide is, you know, did we do a good job writing the law that's codified in those books? Because those are the laws of the land for the people of Wyoming.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Senator. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
A couple of summers ago, the nonprofit StoryCorps hosted an oral history project here in Wyoming, in which veterans and their families recorded honest and personal stories about their military experience. We're excited to share another one of those conversations now with our listeners. Today, we hear from 64-year-old Tim Shepard as he looks back on his extensive military career, sharing the wisdom he has learned along the way.
What was it like being the youngest of four and growing up in Wisconsin?
Well, it was really unusual, mainly because our family went through a lot of tragedy. My dad was killed in a construction accident just after I turned two. Our Uncle John lived with us, and he was killed in 1963. We lived with my grandpa. He was killed in 1968. And we lived with my Uncle Jimmy, and he was killed in 1969. Then in 1976, our house burns to the ground and our mom is killed. So it was when I say it was tragedy filled, it really was. And I only say that because it really had an impact on all of us as far as how we were living life. Hard to get over, get involved with some really bad drugs, and again, have no sense of purpose. But I feel like I should. So one day a friend says that he was going to join the Army. And so I said, well, if you're going to join the Army, Jeff, I'll join with you. So he and I went down to the recruiting station and signed up. And we joined the Army. When I take the entrance exam to join the Army, I had a score that was close to the very top score that you could get, so I could do whatever I wanted. So I signed up to be a helicopter mechanic. But I end up as the honor graduate of my school, but we never touch a helicopter, which I thought was odd. But so I get my orders, and they're sending me to the 101st airborne air assault, and that's a legendary unit. And I was like, I don't believe Tim Shepard is supposed to be in the 101st Airborne Air Assault. The first day, our section sergeant says, well, it's great to have you. We love to have an honor graduate. Let's issue your toolbox. I said, toolbox? What do you think I'm going to do with a toolbox? And it was downhill from there. I was a terrible mechanic. I had no business being a mechanic. I ruined two tail rotors. And so they say, you're off the flight line. And I was like, well, this is terrible. But the company commander, or the first sergeant, said, we think we want you to be the company clerk. Well, I was Radar O'Reilly on steroids. I mean, all of the platoon sergeants loved me, the platoon leaders, they all came to me. I took care of them. I spent 2 years doing that, and it was fabulous. My company commander stopped me one day, and he never called me by my first name, but he said, Tim, tell me what you're going to do. When you're done, what are you going to do? And so I told him, and he said, no, that's not what you're going to do. It's not? He said, no, you're going to get out, you're going to go back to school, you're going to finish your degree, and you're going to join the National Guard and go through their officer candidate school, and then you're going to come back on active duty. And so that doesn't sound like what I had in mind. And he said, no, that's what you need to do. So I did exactly what he said, and I left Fort Campbell, Kentucky, which is where the 101st is, and I moved to Laramie, Wyoming, to go to school, to finish my degree. And at the same time, I joined the National Guard and went through their officer candidate school, and in July of 1983, I was commissioned a second lieutenant. One thing that when I think back on my career, I never forgot what it was like to be a private. I never forgot what it was like to be treated, whether it was well or not so well. And so I worked really hard not to treat people the way I didn't like being treated, kind of the golden rule of doing unto others as I wanted to have done to me. By far, your most precious resource is your people. And the most precious of those people are your privates. And if you'll lead that way, you'll be successful. Because they'll make you successful. Because they're really talented. You just have to give them the opportunity to succeed.
That was Hazel Diaz interviewing Tim Shepard for our Veterans Story Corps project that airs monthly. It was produced by Tor Evanstead. You can hear more from the project at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Next, we'll hear students pretending to be cows. Why? Stay with us to find out on Open Spaces.
You already listen to public radio, but what if public radio could listen back? It does on the NPR One app. Hear local, national, and international news plus podcasts based on what you like. The more you listen, the more it gets to know you. Download NPR One at your app store.
Did you know that all 6 episodes of Human Nature's latest season are out right now? That's right. Season 9 of our award-winning podcast has a little bit of everything. A Wyoming man who spent his summer working as a night shepherd in Switzerland.
All I could hear was my breathing and the steps, and everything was so dark. And I just thought, okay, this must be what it's like to be an astronaut on the moon.
The story of one of the biggest animal rescues in history.
And I picked up the phone and they said, when can you get here? And so the next day, I actually took a plane because it never occurred to me what was ahead for me over the next few weeks.
And a woman who followed the gray whale migration hundreds of miles with her son.
I was exhausted one evening, fed up of trying to work. I'd had a really bad day. And so I was like, right, I'm not working. I'm going to read about whales.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. It's no secret that ranchers are having a hard time. They're experiencing more drought, more conflict, and land is expensive. The average age of a rancher these days is 58. But this fall, the University of Wyoming launched a new degree called Ranch Management and Agricultural Leadership, or RMAL for short. The goal is to re-envision the rancher of the future. This summer, the program's first registered student attended a UW-sponsored ranch camp for ag students around the world. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards tagged along.
In the rolling green hills north of Sheridan, University of Wyoming instructors Brian Sabade and Barton Stamm lead a herd of ranching students to the bottom of a steep, grassy slope. Then they introduce them to an activity.
Now you're going to be imagining yourself as the cow, okay?
The goal is to teach students how to graze cattle by awarding them points for finding different kinds of forage. The hillside is covered in colorful flags.
This hillside here is your pasture. And those flags up there are the plants you're going to be eating. Blue represents grasses, red represents forbs, and yellow represents shrubs.
They get 15 points for every blue flag that they grab, 10 for red flags, and 5 for yellow. This ranch camp is what the university's new ranch degree hopes to achieve. Lots of hands-on learning and experimentation and team teaching. UW junior Ethan Mills was trying to piece together a double major of ranch business in rangeland. This degree puts all that together for him, and he was the first to sign up. Mills grabs a partner, Tanner Page. He'll be the calf, he says. Page will be his mom. And then the game is on.
All right, go to it.
Go grazing.
The students all lumber off, cow style. Mills and Page are determined to win.
Wow, we are the laziest cows there ever was.
Lazy because they make a beeline for the blue flags, the grasses, and ignore the forbs and shrubs, just like cows might do. But they almost lose entirely when a grizzly bear attacks them from above.
Oh, it's the grizzly bear.
Grizzly bear.
I'm going to eat you, Ethan Mills.
They run as fast as they can down the hill to escape. This kind of out-of-the-box learning is intrinsic to the new degree program. Every student will do a series of internships, starting as a ranch hand and progressing to ranch management. Mills says baked into the program is an emphasis on wise natural resource management.
What they drill is that soil and water in your land is the most important resource that you have, and being able to manage that and manage the wildlife that's on it at the same time is extremely important.
For the university, resisting old dogmas has become urgent. Back in 2018, they held a summit with all the stakeholders who had a vested interest in the College of Agriculture.
And they wanted to relay the message that some of our students weren't necessarily meeting the needs of the industry.
That's Randall Violet, the director of RMAL.
One of the glaring things that we kept hearing from our stakeholders is we need the emotional intelligence kinds of things. We need conflict resolution, communication, just dealing with people.
A good communicator might not be what you think of when you imagine a cowboy. They choose that life because it is so solitary. But student Ethan Mills says it's time cowboys represented themselves with public land agencies, lawmakers, and each other.
You're either your biggest advocate or enemy, and that's when you're dealing with your consumers or the public, are you going to be able to show that what you're doing is for the good of the animal and the good for the population which you're feeding?
UW range professor Derek Skasta says the new generation of ranchers have lots of opportunities right now, with new markets to sell carbon offsets or free-range meat or host solar farms.
There's the big picture of, I want to take care of the land, feed society, and leave this place better than I found it. That's like a higher, more noble motive. And I think these students have that, but you got to help them kind of realize it.
And realizing that potential is what UW's new ranch degree program is all about.
Everyone, tally up your points.
The grazing contest comes to a close. Mills and Page have one of the highest scores, but their instructors want to know what would have lured them to the top where there was lots more grass.
What if I'd had a bunch of Snickers bars up there? Or some ice cream.
Ice cream.
Okay, that would have gotten you up there.
Or like some like supplements or salt.
Okay.
It begs the question, what will it take to get these young ranchers to hike a little farther to try new agricultural strategies themselves? For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Catch a longer version of this story on The Modern West, available starting on November 13th. Find it on their podcast at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Landlocked foodies in our region are increasingly buying wild salmon in bulk. Fishing companies are bringing hundreds of thousands of pounds of fish directly from Alaska to customers. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach reports on a community salmon share in eastern Idaho.
Excitement is in the air as people spend one of the last Saturdays of summer lined up in a coffee shop parking lot in Teton Valley. They're here for fresh Alaskan salmon, 10, 20, or 40 pound boxes of fillets and ground sockeye.
This is it right here. So see, it just looks so beautiful.
Standing at the front of the line under a blue tent, Carlin Hervig points to the vacuum-sealed bag of bright red-orange ground-up salmon. She's picking up for a neighbor and getting herself some foot-long fillets to serve at dinner parties.
Because you see it's a pretty big piece, so once you're going to thaw one out, you kind of want to know, okay, I'm having friends over or I can serve this many portions.
Hervig has been coming back for this wild salmon for years. It comes from Bristol Bay in southwest Alaska. Fed by six major rivers, it's home to the largest wild salmon run on the planet. Hervig says the fish from there just tastes better than the farm-raised stuff you find at the grocery store. And wild salmon is hard to come by in this part of Idaho, since many varieties are endangered and illegal to fish.
I think the first year we delivered 7 boxes, and we thought that was a huge deal.
Amanda Leszewski is with Kwijak Fish Company.
Now it's grown into, 70 people?
That's 3,600 pounds of salmon today. She first got hooked on Alaskan salmon after spending a summer at a cannery in Naknek after high school. Now she and a friend from the cannery run this company, working with fishermen on the Kwijak River in Bristol Bay.
When we first were starting out, we just assumed that we were going to be a company that put fish in a box and shipped it all over the country, and right away we stopped doing that.
And opted to keep operations small. They now ship the salmon by barge and truck to Montana and load it all into a bright blue freezer-cold trailer. Then once a year, Leszewski and her sister haul it to different pickup spots in Montana and Idaho. They started serving this small community in 2016.
They care about knowing where it comes from because the economy around here is focused around agriculture and food and just a desire to support small producers because a lot of them are small producers themselves.
In recent years, at least 3 other companies have started bringing wild salmon here and across the state line in Jackson Hole. Kirsten Sterling runs a similar company out of Salt Lake City.
We all started out with this because it was like, oh, you're a fisherman in Alaska, so how do we get fish?
Sterling fishes every summer in Bristol Bay, living in a 700-square-foot cabin with her husband and 2 kids. For the rest of the year, she sells salmon in the Mountain West.
If you're an expecting mother, this is like the most perfect food for you ever. If you are a little baby, this is the most perfect food for you ever. If you're a dog, this is the most perfect food for you ever.
Sterling's business has been growing, but part of her job is still convincing people that wild sockeye is healthier than fish raised on farms, which are fed pellets, antibiotics, and dyes. But her fish is ruby red from eating plankton and krill in the open ocean.
You're paying a little bit more, but it's so much better for you, and it tastes so much better.
A single piece of wild salmon can be about $18 a pound, about twice as much as the farm-raised grocery stuff. But it can be cheaper if you buy in bulk or ahead of the season, like folks in Teton Valley, Idaho.
30 pounds of salmon fillets.
Back at the pickup, local resident Kyle Barris is cramming 15 boxes into his Subaru Outback. He works at a nearby ranch. Some of the fish is for him, but he's also picking up for family and neighbors.
I've come to just really like these guys. I like supporting Amanda, and I like supporting, small business.
Can you taste the difference?
I don't know. It's delicious. I know that.
And just like having a deer or elk in the freezer, Barris says he's excited to have all this wild salmon stored up for the long winter ahead. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Merzbach in Teton Valley, Idaho.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Hannah Haberman, today's audio producer, and Ivy Engel, our digital producer. And thank you to Cody Hume, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.